We also, I think, have a bad habit of wanting to sugarcoat history and wanting to say, oh, this great thing happened, isn't that amazing, without acknowledging the fact that sometimes, you know, big innovations happened on the backs of marginalized people and groups. And I think that we could do a better job of holding the good thing that somebody may have done and acknowledging the bad thing or the bad way in which they did that thing.
You might think that science is boring, hard to understand, or maybe you believe that scientists are hiding the truth from you about aliens or chemtrails. Well, we're here to prove that wrong. Whether you love science or you think it sucks, this is the show for you. Welcome to the 8th episode of Science Sucks. Okay, so fun fact about the number 8. In Hinduism, 8 is the number of wealth and abundance. In Buddhism, its significance is found in the Eightfold Path, which are the core 8 practices to achieving liberation from the cycle of death and rebirth. In Judaism, it's on the 8th day after birth that a baby is traditionally circumcised. In Chinese and Japanese cultures, 8 is considered a lucky number, for different reasons, interestingly enough. Anyway, this Wikipedia rabbit hole is not nearly as interesting as my guest this week, who I am thrilled to introduce to you. Charlie Yvonne Simpson is a playwright, teacher, and performer in New York City. Her play, Behind the Sheet, recently had its world premiere at the Ensemble Studio Theater. Her play shared the dark history of gynecology, in which a doctor experimented on enslaved women without anesthetic. It tells the story of a great medical breakthrough through the eyes of a community of enslaved Black women who were involuntarily involved in the discovery. The play has been praised for giving a voice to the voiceless, and the New York Times wrote, "Behind the Sheet may be a quiet play, but its echoes are thunderous." I am absolutely thrilled to have Charlie on today's episode of Science Sucks. Before we begin, just a little content warning so you know what you're getting into. We are discussing issues of racism, sexism, slavery, gynecological exams performed on women without their consent. There's some graphic medical language, so I encourage you to keep listening, but just letting you know what will be in store. So without further ado, here is Charlie. Firstly, just to introduce you, so you're a playwright, you're a teacher. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do? And feel free to kind of share your journey and how you got to where you are today.
Yes, no, I am a playwright and a professor these days, mostly. I teach playwriting at SUNY Purchase, which is in New York. And I also teach with an organization called The Engaging Educator, which basically uses improv to work on communication skills. And so we have a bunch of different classes like storytelling and small talk. And it's usually working with folks who are not theater people and sort of using these weird theater skills that we have picked up along the way to help folks communicate better. So that's basically what I do. And I sort of ended up here after a bunch of other jobs. I was a middle school tutor and teaching assistant. I was a social worker, and then school getting my master's of social work. I worked at a camp for kids on the spectrum and with emotional support needs, and I was a yoga teacher, and I was all these different things. And then about 7-8 years ago, a friend of mine called and sort of was like, "This is all nice and all, but like, why aren't you doing what you want to do?" And so that's when I began to focus on playwriting again. And luckily, in the last few years, I've been able to add teaching playwriting back into the mix, which is great.
That's amazing. Yeah, I feel like a lot of young people, like I'm young, I'm in my early 20s, and it's like I have a lot of jobs. It's a lot. It's hard to find what it is you want to do more. So I'm glad you found it.
It's nice, and all those things. I mean, I think all those different jobs and paths help me as a writer, just because I have sort of this like weird experience in these different worlds and meeting different people, and I really, really appreciate that, especially when it comes to writing.
Yeah, none of it is wasted.
Exactly.
Yeah, I was so interested in hearing about your play, Behind the Sheath, your most recent one, and that's what I wanted to talk about today. So could you tell us a little bit about it, what inspired it, and what is it about?
Yeah, sure. So the play is called Behind the Sheath, as you said, and it sort of the general synopsis is that the play follows this character by the name of Philomena, who is an enslaved black woman working for a doctor by the name of Dr. George Berry. And Dr. George Berry is a doctor who's working to find the cure or how to fix obstetric fistulas, which I can go into what that is in a moment. And so he's working on that, and he uses Philomena as his sort of assistant until sort of he gets this new patient, and it sort of changes everything. So that's sort of like the general synopsis. It is inspired by the work and life of Dr. J. Marion Sims, who is considered the father of American gynecology. And he, in the 1840s, experimented on enslaved black women in order to find a way to fix obstetric fistulas. So I'm using that history to highlight the story of the women that he worked on, of whom we know three of their names, Annika, Betsy, and Lucy. And so my play begins to shed light on what their experiences may have been like.
Yeah, wow. And I can imagine that there's gaps in the history that you are filling in, and it's a lot of, like, understanding what that is.
For sure. I mean, you know, J. Marion Sims has he wrote an autobiography, so we have that. And obviously we have, you know, other journals and sort of historical documents that sort of point to the work that he was doing and the women that he was working on, but unfortunately, we don't have a tremendous amount of information about the women themselves. Though through doing this play, I read more, and I've been contacted by folks who are doing more research to sort of fill in those gaps, which is great. And people have been able to find out information about the women that I didn't even have when I was writing the play. So there's definitely a push to know more about these women and to sort of shed light on what their story is. But my play definitely, you know, attempts to highlight what the experience may have been like, while also acknowledging the fact that, you know, it's impossible for me, a person, you know, in 2019 to actually really know what that experience was like.
Yeah, yeah, wow. What kind of people are contacting you out of curiosity, like scientists or historians or...
Quite a few historians have contacted me, or I've been in contact with them. So this play was commissioned by an organization, by two organizations who sort of partnered together, Ensemble Studio Theater and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, which gives money to organizations, arts organizations, to put more science and technology, like, in the arts. So I got a commission to write this play, because it's a play about science. In the process of writing it, I talked with historians. There were science advisors who would send along articles. And so there's that kind of connection, so I had while I was writing it. We also had a lot of talkbacks, so people would come see the show. And then after the show, we'd have conversations where I might be present, the director might be present, and we had experts. So we had a gynecologist who actually still works on obstetric fistulas now in different parts of the world. We had historians. We had public health advocates. And so they themselves would reach out, and then there's actually been people have gone to my website and found me that way to share information that they have found. So it's mostly historians and scientists. I do also get contacted by doctors who are often curious about whether or not the play will make it to them, because it's history that unfortunately a lot of people don't know.
Wow, yeah, for sure. I noticed an article that the famous gynecologist that the who was doing the experiments, his statue was taken down in New York City, which is very interesting.
Yeah, in the process of writing this, well, the way I found out about this history itself was in part because folks have been protesting or had been protesting this statue of him that was along the perimeter of Central Park in New York City for years, and in part because of, I mean, not in part, because of this history of him working on enslaved black women, and the big thing is that he worked on them without the use of anesthesia. Anesthesia, the beginning of his experimentation wasn't wildly used. It was used more by the end, and so that has been a big part of the history, and sort of how it is perpetuated or has helped perpetuate this idea that black women or black people don't feel pain in the same way. And so, so for years people were protesting the statue, and several years ago, either I think like 2014 or 2015, I read about it, and I was fascinated. I was also fascinated by the fact that I had never heard of him or these women or his work. He's the person who created a speculum, and if you're a person with a uterus and you go to the gynecologist, they're using a version of a speculum on you. And it was crazy to me that we didn't know sort of the origin story of that tool. And so that was really what piqued my interest. And then in the process of writing it, over the years while I was writing it, more and more people were beginning to point out the problem of having him there. You know, having his statue there. And so his statue was actually removed. It'll be almost a year. It'll be a year in April that they removed it from Central Park.
I definitely understand your frustration with, like, why didn't I know this? Because I think with a lot of, in quotes, like, women's issues or things that affect primarily women, unfortunately, we don't know about.
it's true. And I think, so actually, the other sort of thing that has been happening or happened in the process of writing this play is that more and more people were finding out about this history and about specifically the women themselves, because there were all these articles about black maternal mortality rates in the States being pretty abysmal. People were pointing to the history of Dr. J. Marion Sims and these the women that he worked on, and how there's a history, like I was saying, of black people, black women not being believed when talking about their pain, and just not being cared for in the same way. And so, it's been interesting because we see it specifically in terms of race, but also in terms of gender. There's a big way in which women themselves are not treated and listened to in the same way that men are when it comes to medical issues. So it's definitely a problem, along several different intersections.
I want to ask about the kind of science-y aspect. So in terms of the fistulas, like, what are those that the doctor was trying to solve? And also, what are some of the innovations that he made in gynecology?
So, and this is, I'm not a scientist, so, there are better ways to probably explain this, but the way that I explain it, sort of just for basic understanding, is that an obstetric fistula is a hole in the birth canal that is usually created when, during labor, when a baby gets stuck in the birth canal, and the baby's head may push against the walls of the birth canal, and it pushes against it, and then what ends up happening is the skin that it's pushing against loses blood flow and dies, and in doing so creates a hole. And that hole can be between the birth canal and the bladder, between the birth canal and the rectum, in a number of other different places. And so what ends up happening is that you have a hole in the birth canal, and blood can go through that hole, urine can go through that hole, feces can go through that hole, and it's a steady stream because there's nothing blocking it. That used to be quite more common throughout the world, with innovations like cesarean sections and actually just, better health. In certain countries, there's obviously been a decline of this, or it is fixed, as soon as it happens. But there are countries in Africa and in Asia where we still see a high number of people suffering from obstetric fistulas.
Because of the part of the body that it's in, and because there's not a lot of like extra skin laying around there, it was incredibly difficult to close the holes. Unfortunately, with something like that, you can't get halfway. You have to figure out a way to close the hole completely. And so that was difficult. And you're also talking about a time when, you know, we didn't know some things that are pretty obvious now. For instance, he left a sponge in one of the women to sort of try to keep it dry and keep, to keep the area dry and clean. But we know now leaving something like a sponge in is not great over a long period of time, right? That actually causes more problems than it would solve. Or he also didn't know exactly which material to use to close the fistula. So he, at the time, silk sutures were popular. He tried that and it didn't work. Lead sutures, which we now, people are like, oh my God, lead. that was a material that was used. And that did not work. And he eventually figured out that silver wire worked. And we know now that silver has sort of antibiotic properties. And so, it makes sense now that we sort of are steps ahead. But, it took him years to figure that out and then to figure out a method of closing it so that the whole hole would close and that there would be no seepage or leakage from the formal hole.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about the women that have these experiences? Because your play is about them and their humanizes their experiences instead of just a topic of history or a topic of science.
Sure. So, I mean, in the play attempts to acknowledge the women's pain, both with, so when someone is suffering from obstetric fistula, not only is it obviously uncomfortable, and obviously, there's a smell attached to it. It's, they are sometimes sitting in urine and feces and other bodily fluids, and so there's a smell attached to that, and there's a shame attached to that as well. If you think about it, urine is quite like acidic, right? And it burns. At times, folks will get scarring down their legs from burns. Mm-hmm. It was some people lost the ability to walk, and so it was incredibly uncomfortable and painful. And that was just the hole itself. With the experimentation, as I mentioned, there wasn't anesthesia being used, it was quite painful. Many people who have gone to the gynecologist can talk about how uncomfortable a regular gynecological exam might be. Thinking about the sensitivity in that area with that hole, with everything that was going on, imagining, this is not a time, now when someone is using a speculum, they usually lubricate it in some way, right? That is not something that was necessarily being done at that time. It was painful enough that the women had to hold each other down. And so they would sort of assist in these surgeries in that way. They often were cleaning and dressing the post-op wounds and taking care of each other. After procedures, Sims would give the women opium. Opium is addictive, and some of the effects of opium, of not having a sense of where you are, feeling incredibly dehydrated. So these are all things that we imagine these women must have felt. They were essentially sold to Simpsons, bought them, and so they were away from family and friends, which unfortunately is nothing new when we're looking at slavery, but you know, there is something to be said about being sold and moved because of you know, basically a medical experimentation. And so these are the sorts of things that we know. We also know or can imagine that these are women who have lives and have personalities and, you know, were around these other women. And so they were taking care of each other and probably fighting with each other. And all these things. So the play attempts to not only discuss the pain that they were in and the positions that they were in, but also tries to show that they, you know, that they had personalities and, you know, had opinions about what they were going through, and may or may not have been in favor of it. There's a big conversation about, or debate sort of, about whether or not the women consented. I personally think it's ridiculous to talk about consent when someone is enslaved and therefore is, in theory, does not own themselves. Yeah. You know, consent seems like a ridiculous thing to bring up. You know, but there's a discussion about that in the play. You know, I try to highlight that weird line where between maybe they didn't want the surgeries, but they also wanted to be fixed. And so what is that? Also, Anarcha, one of the women we know, she was operated on 30 times before he figured out a way to fix it. And so we're honest about the number of surgeries. And we're honest about the fact that, you know, we can imagine a world in which someone may be hopeful at that first surgery, but dreading the 30th. So the play tries to show all the different sides of that situation that we can.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the play is a wonderful thing that you've done. Why do you think it's important that people hear this story?
I think it's important, you know, to sort of know and acknowledge our history. If there's going to be a statue, or, you know, there are fellowships named after him, there are tools named after him, you know, but he isn't the only person in that equation. Those women. Without them, there wouldn't be these discoveries that he made. So if people really want to remember him, we should be remembering them as well. We also, I think, have a bad habit of wanting to sugarcoat history and wanting to say, oh, this great thing happened, isn't that amazing, without acknowledging the fact that sometimes, you know, big innovations happened on the backs of marginalized people and groups. And I think that we could do a better job of holding the good thing that somebody may have done and acknowledging the bad thing or the bad way in which they did that thing. And so I think we just as a people need to get more comfortable with those sorts of what feels like contradictions, but really is just sort of reality. So I think it's important for people to know that. And I especially think it's important now. I myself am a Black woman. I'm in my 30s, so I'm at a time when I'm wondering if I want to have a child. And I'm dealing with the very present fact and worry that, like, I'm more likely to die in childbirth or during pregnancy, just by being a Black woman, than a white woman of the same age and of the same socioeconomic background. And so that's just a reality that I live anyway. And I think it's important to know sort of the history of how we got here. And so it's not actually that surprising to me that Black women find themselves in this position when this is the history of gynecology. And so I think it's important to know that. And I also think it's important, you know, there have been gynecologists who have come up to me and they're like, I didn't know this. And I think it's important to know this so we don't end up repeating something. And people are like, oh, that could never happen again. And I you know, I'm a little bit more pessimistic. I rather we know the history, we acknowledge the history, so whenever we begin to walk towards something that looks and feels similar, somebody says, hey, no, we did this before and it was terrible. Yep. So yeah,
definitely. I think a lot of doctors aren't aware of the history of medicine and the challenges that brings with it.
Well, yeah. You know, I have a friend who was sort of in medical school at the time, and he was like, you know, it was at least in his program, you know, it's not required. You know, it was sort of like a class was an elective. You know, wow. So that's not necessarily. You know, when you're busy learning about all these other things, medical history is maybe not on your list of things, the classes to take.
you know, which becomes interesting then when you step into the field and you step into this field with such a complicated history.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't know that, but there's electives.
At least in that program. So I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are places that focus on that. But not every medical program does.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's gaps in any medical program Yeah. I'm wondering, what is the favorite part of your work? So maybe the part where you're writing plays or teaching. What is your favorite part?
I feel like they're different. I mean, I really love teaching. I think teaching actually makes me love playwriting more. That learning about the craft and teaching it and showing the possibilities are really, really exciting. That might be a favorite part of my work. And I think the other part of my work is that I find really exciting is when it finally gets an audience or gets a group of people to work on it. It's really this collaboration. It's really about being in the room together and breathing and watching this thing and sort of connecting and communing in this way. And I think it's actually a really beautiful thing that we often don't get anymore. I mean, I sit at home and watch Netflix by myself. I barely want to answer my phone. I text, where I'm not connecting in the same way. And theater specifically sort of usually forces us into a situation where we have to at least be in a room with somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so powerful. A lot of jobs are just mostly online, so it's cool that you get to work every day with different people.
Sad thing is it's not every day, but when it does happen, it's very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any advice for young women who are interested in doing what you do?
I think that unfortunately, women, marginalized folks, we are often silenced. We're told that our opinions and our thoughts and feelings aren't important. I've spent a lot of my life being called too sensitive, too dramatic, too pensive, too quiet, that is sometimes used as a way to silence me and to silence sort of my opinions and my thoughts. And I think a big piece of advice is to fight against that. And regardless of your mode of expression, making sure that you are, actually expressing and not shutting down because someone at some point in time sort of told you or made it seem like you should. I think that's really hard. It's something that I deal with all the time. I can write a lot of stuff. I actually find it harder to talk about things because of that. I figure if we can sort of begin to nip that in the bud the younger we are, then hopefully the form of expression that speaks most to you will show itself and you won't be afraid to use it.
Yeah, that's very powerful. I was looking at your website and the information for your play, and there was a review that stood out to me that said, "Behind the Sheet is a quiet play, but the echoes are thunderous." So,
yes, oh, Ben Bradley.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was, I thought that was really interesting because you were talking about like being quiet as like a criticism or, but.
Right, people yeah. try, I spent a lot of my time being quiet and that was, or reading a lot. I got yelled at for reading too much. all of that makes me a better writer today. And it just means I'm better at observing people.
Yeah.
And I'm intuitive. So a lot of times somebody will be like, "How do you know that?" I'll say, "Well, I figured it out because I sat here and I watched you."
Yeah.
And that's a strength. So don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
Amazing. Yeah. Being quiet isn't a bad thing. It could be very strong. Amazing. Yeah. And can you tell us where people can find you? Let's say your social media or any upcoming projects.
My website is my name. It's Charlie, Charly, Yvonne, Evon, Simpson, Simpson, like the TV show, .com. And you can find me on all of the social medias. I think actually every one, I'm like Charlie E. Simpson, at Charlie E. Simpson. Mm-hmm. And so you can find me there. Upcoming events and projects. I am
I have a play called Junk, which is having a National New Play Network Rolling World premiere, which basically means all of these theaters are going to do it, and they all get to call it a world premiere. The first one was in North Carolina. The next one starts in Portland, Oregon next week, and then it goes to Austin, Texas, and then to Georgia. And then I'm working on a piece that I should be writing now, but I'm not, that will be in New York, next month as well.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. I'll include your links below. But yeah, thanks so much for talking to me. And
yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm so, so grateful to have spoken with Charlie this week. I reached out to her through her contact form on her website, which is very out of the blue, so I'm happy that we could actually connect. Charlie is not a scientist, but her play has sparked discussion in the scientific and medical community about which stories are being told and which ones are being left out. I've included some information for you in the show notes to do more reading if you're curious. It is so important that the stories of marginalized people are told, like in Charlie's play, especially when it comes to something as vulnerable as medicine. I have linked Charlie's social media and website in the show notes below, so go check her out. And if you're in town at the same time as one of her plays, be sure to check them out. That's it from me. You can find me on YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram at Science with Evie, and follow this podcast at Science Sucks Pod on Twitter. That's it for me, and have a lovely, empowered week.